This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Robin Dow producing. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. And thanks to Julie Baxter Pear, who did sterling work yesterday, sitting in the host chair. It's always a pleasure to have her back at the network where she once worked. And she is quite special, as we know. But in studio is a special guy in the community, and really, to have the position he has and to come from the family from which he hails, he's not as well known as he should be, Jude Melville. Jude Melville's real name is David R. Melville. Jude is a nickname, and we'll get to that in a bit, but he was raised in Bossier Parish, and he graduated cum laude from Harvard, which he attended on a military scholarship, and then received a master's degree from the London School of Economics, and then logged 5 years in the U.S. Air Force, achieving the rank of captain, serving in Turkey, Oman, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and at the Pentagon. And he went back as a civilian to Iraq just as the war was starting in 2003. So he's been around the world and back, and now he's in Baton Rouge, and he's president of Business First Bank, which caters to business, and he is the co-founder. And good morning to you, sir.
Morning.
And you come
honored to be here. I appreciate it.
Well, and Jude and I have seen each other for years, and it's an overdue request, and he accepted, and I am happy that he did. I know you don't do a lot of these, but I knew Buddy Romer well, and you certainly have a close connection to him.
I do. Uncle, technically. But also a longtime close friend and mentor as well, so, and business partner.
And he was on the ground floor with you, right?
Right. Well, really, he was the founder, and I supported him. And I always say that he kind of tricked me into being a banker, because I was off in the Middle East, and I think he wanted me to come home and convinced me to come help him with a 6-month project. And as usual, he was a pretty good convincer, and so I did, and here we are. 18 years later.
And he had been involved in a bank earlier, which was successful, and he sold that one, right?
He did. It was called the Business Bank of Baton Rouge. And he actually first got me involved in thinking about expanding that one. But then that bank did end up selling. And so we started again, learning some lessons from the first time. And probably didn't envision where we'd be today. So we've been blessed with more opportunity than we realized, and it's been a good journey.
Now, Buddy Romer is remembered for his politics, and he was pretty good at that, although he lost his last couple of runs for governor. But after that 95 race, he decided to go another route, and he's a guy who reinvented himself at 52 years old and had wild success in the business world, which people don't really know that much about, first with the Sterling Group, with Joe Tregel, and then with these banks. And he was a person who I know in 1995, when he was 53, he didn't have any money. But when he died, and to his credit, it's the American dream, he died a wealthy man. He did well, but I presume some others did well along with him, both his clients and those who were his investors who were along for the ride.
Well, usually people do best when they make others better, right? I think he was a good example of that, and certainly I admire his ability to kind of reinvent himself at an age that I used to think was old. I'm getting a little close to that myself now, but certainly have always admired him for that. And you know, one thing about Buddy was banking was very much in line, community banking in particular, and I know we'll talk about community banking in the context of the bigger crisis that seems to be talked about a lot right now. But community banking was very much in line with a lot of his political goals in terms of helping small businesses, helping people that were underbanked, helping the economy, the local economy. So it really was a pretty natural fit. Just use different words.
Well, your bank. I see Drew Brees everywhere, so obviously he's part of the team, and it is now expanded tremendously. How big is it now?
We are about $6 billion in assets, and we are over most of Louisiana. So we're from Shreveport to Rayville, east of Monroe. So up on that portion of Louisiana along I-20. And then we are all along I-10, you know, from Sulphur and Lake Charles over to the North Shore and down to Houma through New Orleans. We're also in Dallas, and we're in Houston as well. So, you know, one of the things about banking that is kind of an imperative is diversification. So mm-hmm. we have certainly tried to create depth within a diverse footprint. And so it's not really about being $6 billion. It's really about how many clients can you serve? And we have about 110,000 clients now. And like I said earlier, more successful than we dreamed we would be. And at the same time, hopefully just getting started.
You plan on even getting bigger?
Yeah, I don't know about bigger, but continue to get better.
Well,
you know, bigger is certainly a part of being a bank. And I think some of the crisis that the banking industry is going through today and all the crises that we've been through previously certainly lead banks to need to get bigger. So I'm sure there'll be some momentum there, but being big's not the goal.
877-217-5757 for Jude Melville, the president of B1 Bank. That's what your moniker is.
Yeah, B1 Bank. We changed our name about 6 years ago, I think. You know, when we started doing acquisitions, we've done five bank acquisitions now in addition to organic growth. We diversified into more of a, having more of a component of retail, and B1 has more of a resonance with retail, and also feels a little more future looking. You know, you start to think about digital banking, websites, yeah. things of that nature. So,
I remember the B1 bomber.
Yeah, me too.
But in fact, Buddy Romer had a great story about the horse trading that was involved to get him to vote for that. But he did it. And as I recall, it was a close vote. But Silicon Valley Bank, it catered to the tech industry, and it wasn't a newbie either. It was around for three decades. It crashed
40,
on March
40 years, yep.
Crashed on March 10th. What the heck happened?
A lot of things, but I think there are probably three kind of main things that you can point to. One is that they didn't do what we've been doing over the years, which is really try to diversify your exposure. So I talked earlier about our geographic footprint, and it's not really about being bigger; it's about being more diversified, which means safer, sounder mm-hmm. Over time. There's a lot that's hard to predict about life, and you know. Since I have Reverend Andrews here in the room with me, I'll quote one of my favorite Bible verses, Philippians 4:12. In all things I shall be both full and hungry. And there is a point at which concentration, and that obviously wasn't written with banking in mind, but I do think about it in terms of being balanced. And there are times when even good things can become bad things if there's too much of it. Mm-hmm. It becomes too much of a focus. And what happened with Silicon Valley Bank is that nearly half their business came from one industry. And so it was a good industry for a long time, still will be a good industry in the future. But every industry has ups and downs. And as a bank, when you've exposed yourself to too much concentration during the downtimes, you're disproportionately hurt. Now, they weren't hurt in terms of asset quality. The tech industry hadn't yet had asset quality problems. But they had deposit problems. With the increase in rates, new monies weren't being invested into the tech industry. Silicon Valley Bank's deposit base was based on investments by venture capitalists into the tech industry. And so when that slowed down, the bank suffered from not having enough funding. Now that happened, so that's one thing, over-concentration on a deposit base in a single industry. And then the second thing is that part of their business model was to rely heavily upon the investment portfolio side of their house for income. So a typical community bank has maybe 15-20% of their balance sheet is in mm-hmm. investments. The rest we try to loan out. And that's kind of our mission, is to loan money in the local community. And then the investment portfolio is there to provide liquidity to help us make those community-based loans. So Silicon Valley Bank had a little bit of a different approach in that they would take their deposits and they would try to make money in the investment portfolio primarily. They had about 60%, 65% of their balance sheet was in an investment portfolio, which sounds safe on the surface level. But when rates move as dramatically as they have, there's an inverse correlation with the value of that portfolio. And so Silicon Valley, because they had so many of their assets tied up in bonds, when the Federal Reserve raised rates, it really dramatically decreased the value of their bond portfolio. So in normal times, that might not have mattered that much. But when you also have the liquidity challenges, you want to take a break?
Yeah, we do have to. You know it pretty well. You did it before the music. 877-217-5757, back after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. A bit more time with Jude Melville, the president of B1 Bank. And on deck is Chris Andrews, one of our most compelling and occasionally provocative guests we feature on this show every now and then. And hopefully we'll have Jude Melville back soon. Captain Melville served 5 years in the U.S. Air Force. He did so in war zones and has a degree from Harvard and from the London School of Economics. And he is the co-founder of B1 Bank, which now has $6 billion in assets and 110,000 clients. And
let me clarify, Jim. I was the gopher for the founder of B1 Bank. Certainly, I was there day. I was there day one, but
the
I wouldn't,
gopher being Buddy
I
Romer.
I don't think I was quite prepared to be the co-founder.
But I know Buddy Romer well. He's a visionary guy, but I'm sure while he was reading books at Barnes and Noble, you were on the ground floor making things happen, and that's what often leaders are supposed to be.
Yeah, no, that's right.
But he wasn't in there at the teller window, I can guarantee you.
Yeah, he was a good delegator. How about that?
I remember when Jerry Stovall got fired at LSU as football coach, he got a job at L&B. Hmm. And I was right downtown, so I went in to say hello to him. And there he was at the teller window. He was learning every aspect of the bank. Somehow, if Brian Kelly got fired tomorrow, I don't think we'd see him at the teller window at B1 Bank. But no, you never know. Life is strange. But
different world. Well, he'd be welcome, but I'm not sure he would accept. Jim, I wanted to just finish up real quick, if you don't mind, because I think there are some important
lessons. Well, is this a harbinger of things to come with what happened with Silicon Valley
Bank?
Right,
and that's a good way to put it, and I don't think so. You know, if you think about the things that I said about the two specific kind of unique attributes. You know, one was the lack of diversification in their client base, and two was the over-reliance on the bond portfolio for income as opposed to backing up room. What happened was that the need to provide funding for a base that moved its money very quickly caused them to take losses in their bond portfolio, which ate up their equity, which caused mm-hmm. them to be closed. So most banks in the country, the vast majority of banks and nearly all community banks are structured and run very differently. And we don't have that kind of concentration. We don't have that kind of over-reliance upon yield in the bond portfolio. And we have, Silicon Valley Bank had 97.5% of their funding was over the FDIC insurance level, which means they had a lot mm-hmm. of really large, sophisticated, active clients moving money around on a daily basis, which meant that when the bad news got out and got multiplied, and that's the third thing that happened, by the way, was this 24-hour news cycle, right? So you get everybody panicking on the news, and then you have Twitter broadcasting, multiplying the effect. With all those larger clients that were able to move their money quickly, that caused the run, which then caused the losses. Community banks are much more relationship-oriented, much more two-sided in their interactions with their clients. And like I said earlier, we have 110,000 clients. The average size client has about $38,000 in their account, which means that the vast majority of our clients are under that FDIC insurance coverage limit. So a very different kind of bank than most of the banks in America. And although we're hearing a lot mm-hmm. on the coast about deposits moving, you're not seeing that in community banks. We've actually gained a little bit in the core deposit area since the crisis, and that's not atypical for most community banks today around the country. So if we cannot talk ourselves into a panic, I don't see that necessarily leading to a panic. And sounds like there's some good news today in terms of the regional banks working out their issues. And so, no, I certainly don't think it has to be a harbinger of worse news. And in fact, it may, much like the PPP and the COVID crisis, it may actually turn out to be a renewal of people's awareness of the importance of good, stable community banks in our local communities.
Okay. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Jude Melville. Hi, Phil.
Good morning, Jim. Yes, sir. The question is, how many accounts were over $4.5 million? I understand that there were a number of those accounts, and that they will be made whole.
As far as the Silicon Valley, the President of the United States stepped in on that immediately, and I think he had to quell the disruption that might have happened had people started losing their money. But $4.5 million in an account, is that common? Doesn't the FDIC only cover the first 250 as right. far as a guarantee?
That's correct. No, I wouldn't say that's common. That's a lot of money. I think I might have mentioned earlier, our typical account is more in the $38,000, $40,000 range. And that's averaging our larger clients together with our normal American clients, right? So to think about $4.5 billion being a typical account is unusual. And Silicon Valley Bank had 97.5% of their accounts were over the deposit limit, so over the insurance limit. So mm-hmm. It is my understanding that the government decided that they would make all those depositors whole, mm-hmm. which is a whole nother question about moral hazard and what the long-term effect is. But in the short run, it certainly seemed like when you think about the companies that had their payroll accounts and there were lots of individuals there too, and hopefully that helped them kind of get through a tough time. And I would point out the government did not guarantee shareholders, right? So while we made depositors whole, mm-hmm. Shareholders lost their money, and as it should be for risk taken. And so it's not quite the moral hazard it would have been otherwise, and not quite comparable to the action taken during the Great Financial Recession back in the mm-hmm. back in the 08, 09 era.
Now, a listener, Tom on Blue Bonnet, says if ever a man had a resume that was perfect for politics, it's you. You haven't gotten the bug yet. The Romer bug hasn't hitten you yet. Is that a possibility?
I kind of like making a difference every day. And I feel like I can do that in business more efficiently than I can than I could potentially in politics. So,
and your cousin Chaz Romer, I told him, and I think it's fairly evident that if he'd run for Congress in 2014, the year that Garrett Graves won, he would have won. He would have won at that time. He couldn't beat Graves now, but he could have beaten him then, and he would still be in Congress if he so chose, and he might be running for governor like his daddy and go down the line. But why is there this lack of call for the political world that seemed to be more profound with people of your uncle's generation than it is for people you and Chaz's age?
Well, I think that's potentially a really long conversation, but I think part of it has to do with the fact that at that time there was more of a confidence and belief that that's where you could be most effective in terms of making a difference. And I've grown up over decades in which each decade you lose a little bit of confidence in the. Not only the government's ability, but also its centrality to life. You know, there are many other things in life that are important. And for me personally, and I'm certainly not going to speak for Chaz, but if you think about being the leader of a family, If you think about active in church, if you think about being business people, there are lots of all kind of ways to contribute.
Yeah.
And each person needs to kind of figure out the best best way that they can do that.
And
that changes over time, too.
And Jude comes from good stock. His father, David Melville, opened a street church in downtown Baton Rouge a few years back, and that was a brave move. And you are David R. Melville III, but they call you Jude, and why do they call you Jude?
Well, it took you one guess earlier to find out, and most people get it pretty quickly.
And Robin Dow, being the intrepid producer that she is, can you got it. Let's close with David R. Melville, better known as Jude Melville, with the number one song of all time from the Beatles. Of all their big hits, this was the biggest of them all. 1964, by the way, they had 30 songs in the top 10. Here's their most well-received.
Ladies and gentlemen, there you see the great...
Well, that was...
Hey Jude, there you go.
There you go.
That's the first time anybody's ever done that. I never get people singing so.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing, your number 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. The Reverend Chris Andrews is in the house, and for more than 20 years, he was pastor at First Methodist downtown in Baton Rouge. And then the last decade, a little more than that, he's been pastor of Jubilee Pioneers. He's extremely active in our community, and he is a man who has walked the walk. He's had some tough blows in his life, but I think he is a great student of humanity. And over the last few years, we have been accused of becoming less tolerant of each other, and I think that's true. And by the way, I'm going to show some examples of how both sides are guilty of that on the political side. But we did have a insurrection in Washington that was primarily the responsibility of one man, Donald John Trump, who, as we know, is in some legal hot water, and whatever happens on that front, we will be covering it like few, if any, other places right here on WRKF. Now, Susan Faludi, right before the 2020 election, described Trump and Biden in these ways, and this was right before the election. She says, Mr. Trump, Mr. Biden evoke different brands of manliness. Mr. Trump channels old-fashioned machismo, aggressive, physically tough, physically strong, never back down. Mr. Biden models a more complex 21st century version of masculinity, compassion and empathy and care and a personal narrative of loss. And I thought that kind of described it, although, as we know, Mr. Trump was anything but tough, but he certainly gave the impression that he was a tough guy. And in some ways, he probably is. I don't know how he gets up in the morning with so many things in his world that would drive most of us crazy, but he is a person, if nothing else, who is resilient. But we do we have that now, that bridge, if you will, between what constitutes a real man and sometimes men have a difficult time navigating that terrain?
Oh, my goodness, Jim, you bring a lot to the table here, those opening comments. We're living in interesting times when insight into human behavior and our whole psychological and spiritual makeup, I think, is always in flux, but perhaps nothing like we're experiencing now. And certainly, to use the examples of President Biden and former President Trump, they are quite different individuals, and they manifest their personalities in totally different ways. And, you know, M. Scott Peck wrote a book called The Road Less Traveled many years ago, and he starts it with a compelling sentence. It says, life is difficult. And life is difficult for us all in some way or the other. And how we come back to the difficulties and address that, I think, says a lot about who we are as individuals. And the anger and kind of in-your-face reaction of some camps, to me, that's not the healthy way to go. It's not a good way to build a healthy society. I prefer the more nuanced, calmer, inclusive perspective that I see in some of our leaders. And I think President Biden manifests that.
877-217-5757 is your number. And President Biden, of course, was touched by loss a few times in his life, a son who died with a brain tumor. He lost his first wife. and a child, and his boys were seriously injured in a car accident.
Yep.
And I think his 80 years are full of a lot of wisdom, but there's this perception that he's not all there, and I think that's a cheap shot. But nonetheless, it's perpetuated by those who don't like his politics. And here we are. Biden is a Roman Catholic. Nancy Pelosi is a Roman Catholic. Two best-known Catholics in American politics are Democrats. But Bill Maher has stated that we have too many Catholics on the Supreme Court. We got six of them. 23% of the population is Catholic. I'm part of that. But yet 67% of the Supreme Court is Roman Catholic. Should that be a consideration?
I would be reluctant to ask for a litmus test on almost any front for someone to serve as a Supreme Court justice. But I think that if I were the president and in a position to nominate someone, I might look at that whole tableau and consider that issue of one a majority in one particular denomination, and maybe bring some balance to that. In the same way that I would look at it in terms of race or sex and try to bring some balance to that.
The Reverend Chris Andrews is with us. If you'd like to talk with him, again, 877-217-5757 or talk at talklouisiana.org. And here are some examples of so-called intolerance, and we'll start with the former president, 2016, when he pulled the surprise of surprises and beat Hillary Clinton to win the presidency. Here he is at a rally bloviating about his tough guy mantra as somebody was heckling him.
Bye-bye. Look, see, he's smiling. See, he's having a good time. I love the old days, you know? You know what I hate? There's a guy totally disruptive, throwing punches. We're not allowed to punch back anymore. I love the old days. You know what they used to do to guys like that when they were in a place like this? They'd be carried out on a stretcher, folks. That's true. You know, I love our police, and I really respect our police, and they're not getting enough. They're not. But...
All right. And of course, 140 Capitol police officers were injured on January 6th of 2021 because of Donald Trump stirring up a crowd. But Jeb Bush said, Donald, you're not going to insult your way to the presidency. He said that in the first debate. Well, it worked pretty well for him.
It did. And he's made an industry out of insulting people and telling falsehoods and making outlandish statements. And, you know, I compliment people like you who have such a wonderful platform to offer a different kind of message, and you call him out. I mean, you know, you take him on. I can't understand how some of the leaders in our country, particularly in the Louisiana delegation, just let Trump run wild, and they don't ever get in his face. They don't ever say, listen, that's just blatantly false, and sometimes that needs to happen.
It's because the base loves him, and that base enabled him to win Louisiana by 400,000 votes twice. And in the history of our elections, Donald Trump has more votes than anybody else. He's number one and number two all time. Number three, by the way, I think is Edwin Washington Edwards. But Trump has become an icon in the Southeastern Conference. We are his base. Now, liberals also, in other parts of this country, react to conservatives the same way that people react to Donald Trump, but Trump stirs it up. Well, here's a guy who's a federal judge, an LSU graduate. He goes to Stanford University, Kyle Duncan, and his positions would probably be considered extreme to many, certainly to the crowd at Stanford, and he had to some extent know what he was getting, but at least he had the courage to go into the lion's den. And Robin, can we pull up what happened to, by the way, a very good column today in The Advocate from George Will on
George
this.
Will, right,
but,
I read it.
But here's what happened to Kyle Duncan when he tried to speak at Stanford University.
David, it was the latter, and I'm glad you know what you've experienced this, so you know where I'm coming from. As I walked up to the classroom with the Federal Society president, probably 100 yards off, we heard the protest. And there was kind of a rally going on in the lobby, which is a pretty small lobby outside the classroom. I would estimate that there were at least 100 people. There was chanting, there was jeering, there were signs, there was banging, there was stomping. I was told by someone that I should try to record things. And so I tried to do that, and I went around recording them just sort of as a self-protection thing. I was aghast when I saw the kind of protest outside, because it was like a kind of a monster truck rally sort of situation.
All right. So we get the impression that Judge Duncan was not welcome at Stanford.
Yes. And I echo your reference to George Will's column today. I thought it was a very fine column, as usually he produces. It's sad whenever opposition feels that the only way that it can hold forth its particular position is to shout down your opponent, which is, as I gather, what happened at Stanford, which is a sad thing. I don't think that's good. It's not healthy. We need diverse opinions. We need to listen with respect and with an openness that maybe, I don't know everything, and somebody can teach me something here. Even the most unlikely of people can teach.
David in Atlanta, we're going to a break, but we're sliding you in before. You have the floor. Hi, David.
Good morning, gentlemen. Reverend, in St. Tammany Parish, the owner of a Christian school is under arrest for holding a 4-year-old boy upside down, taping his mouth and his nose, and spanking him. And also in St. Tammany, a Catholic priest has been charged with child molestation.
All right. So some bad things in St. Tammany, where the sheriff went to jail for molesting juveniles over a long period of time. And this is one of the most educated and the wealthiest parish in Louisiana, Chris, which shows you this kind of stuff. Stanford, by the way, is in the most expensive city in the United States to live, Palo Alto. But just because you got money doesn't mean, or education, doesn't necessarily mean that you have wisdom.
Or civility. That's true. And that's a sad state of affairs, but that's the that is the reality. That is the world we're living in. And again, I think we need calmer voices. We need to take some deep breaths. We need to just slow down a little bit and see if there's not something that we as individuals can learn from others who are different from us.
We'll spend a few more minutes with Chris Andrews after this quick pause on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Nancy Regan is on deck, and she has an exceptional book, From Showing Off to Showing Up, An Imposter's Journey from Perfect to Present. It's compelling, and it dovetails well with our conversation with Reverend Chris Andrews. We've had some people waiting in line. I don't know that we'll be able to get to all of you, but we might take a call or two, if you'll be brief. Mr. Broussard, is this in New Iberia? Okay, Mr. Broussard.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I want to commend the young man because, number one, he's doing what he has to do to acknowledge what is wrong with white America, and that they are losing their own liberties just for others not to have it. And it's up to us and y'all, like good white people like y'all, mentioning about this, but be more direct with it, that because you're rich and educated don't mean you have to overlook poverty.
All right. Is everything coming down to race?
Well, race is a big factor and cannot be denied, and it's something that we ought to engage discussions about and grapple with, because we, as a country, will never be whole until we bridge that divide, and it's a big divide.
All right.
It's real.
Barry in Mid-City, please be brief. You'll be our final caller for Chris. Hi, Barry.
Hello, and hello, Reverend Chris. I want to thank you again.
All right, what's your question?
How was it that you had the courage to stand up against David Duke in 92?
Well, that didn't take a lot of courage, Barry. It was, as you well know, you were right there. We were shoulder to shoulder. David Duke is just a person whose viewpoint cannot be tolerated.
I would concur, as I think many would, but he did get 671,000 votes in 1991 for governor.
Tragic.
But I do admire a guy named Herb Rothschild, Jewish man who was a professor at LSU, at one time was head of the local ACLU. When Duke was denied the opportunity to speak at a public place, Rothschild defended his civil rights, as he should have.
Yes.
David Duke has a right to speak, as abhorrent as it is. This is America.
And that's the brilliance of the ACLU. I mean, you know, they'll take on things like that, and I applaud them.
And Herb Rothschild, he said, yeah, I had to defend that SOB's civil rights, but he did it well.
Well, you know, you got to have some standards for all of us.
Thank you, Chris Andrews.
Thank you.
And now we're joined by an exceptional person, and a person who, of course, was at the top of her game and still is, but she built a reputation as the highly rated host of CTV's Atlantic's Live at 5 for 15 years. She also served as the national host of Good Morning Canada, and at one time had 2.5 million viewers. So she may not be known as well in these parts as she was in her home territory, but she has a compelling story to tell, and she has told it in her book, From Showing Off to Showing Up, Nancy Regan's account of an imposter's, as she puts it, journey from perfect to present. It's the ultimate and intimate memoir, and a guide to overcoming something called imposter syndrome, stage fright, perfectionism. And to be on the air and in the media, that is an affliction that is quite profound, isn't it, Nancy?
Hi, Jim. Thanks so much for that intro, and thanks for having me. You know, you just said you thought this conversation might dovetail well with your last one, and I'm kind of shocked at the way it does, because Reverend Chris said, we as a country will never be whole until we face the deep challenges. And that's true, I believe, of us as individuals, that we as human beings on our individual path can't really be whole and live in self-acceptance until we look at what we don't like about ourselves. And that is very much what my book is about, because I, for most of my life, was standing in a spotlight with people shining a light on me, and yet I didn't feel my own light. And that's why I say that I was an imposter, and I was a perfectionist for sure. Here I was broadcasting to, you know, so many people and projecting this air of confidence, but secretly feeling that I am not as good as they think I am. And I had a constant running chatter in my head that was my own self-talk saying, that was a dumb thing to say, and you don't, you know, in the extreme, you don't deserve this job. So what I found in my own life is that I really needed to look at what it was I didn't accept about myself before I could be willing to show up. And in my view, showing off for me means I'm living my life according to everybody else's expectations, looking for praise and looking for acceptance. And showing up is I accept myself, so I'm able to really just be authentically in the world, and then that leads to an ability to contribute in a meaningful way to the world, which is another conversation you were having this morning. You know, the idea of civility in our society, I think, has to start with civility within ourselves, because so many of us are going through the world wearing a mask that says, hey, I've got it all together, when actually we might feel like we're falling apart.
The book is From Showing Off to Showing Up, An Imposter's Journey from Perfect to Present. Now, I remember, I think it was Donna Karan, she had that saying, never let them see you sweat. And
yes.
and there's actually something good in trying to put your best foot forward. I don't think anyone would argue with that. But in this small community that we're in, relatively small, in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, we had a number of media stars in the 80s who got afflicted with substance abuse. And part of it may be related to what you're talking about, because in a community of this size, if you're on television, you're one of the best known people in the community, and you get people patting you on your back, but yet you're in that little box and you're all alone, and sometimes you're insecure, and it's hard to deal with those conflicting emotions, isn't it?
It is, and I think that is not just the course of people in the public eye. I think that all of us deal with that. And in fact, I'll tell you, when my book went to the printer, the day it was delivered to the printer, I kind of went into an anxiety spiral because I am so vulnerable in this first book of mine. And I thought, what have I done? You know, I've really revealed all of myself. And then when it came out and people were reading it, that sort of fear and anxiety completely dissipated because I was rewarded with such a sense of connection, because so many people from different walks of life, different genders, different decades of their lives came back to me and reached out to say, you're telling my story. And we've lived a very different life, but this is how I feel. I feel like a pretender sometimes. I feel like a faker in my own life, and I want to get past that. And what I believe is that when we can accept ourselves fully as a paradox, you know, none of us is all good or all bad, and the more we can accept that sense of paradox within ourselves, the more we can look out into the world, whether it's politics or, you know, just in our community, the way our community is working and with our neighbors, we can accept other people as not being just black or white, gay or straight, right or wrong. And for me, that's what this is about. And it leads to a more joyful life when you can stop worrying about your own perceived, you know, deficiencies.
The book is From Showing Off to Showing Up, An Imposter's Journey from Perfect to Present. Here's a quote from Nancy Reagan. My life was perfect. I was confident and outgoing. I was a deliriously happy wife and mother. I loved my job. That all sounds great, doesn't it? Unfortunately, every one of those statements is false. I was false. How did you pull it off?
I was a really good actor. I was a better actor than anyone knew, and I think that a lot of people in the media are. I think there's a lot of acting involved. I was in a movie. I had a very small part as a reporter with Bill. I was going to say Bill Pullman. Oh my gosh, I'm forgetting the actor from Fargo, William H. Macy.
Yeah, Bill Macy.
And yeah, Bill Macy. And the director in that show had an opportunity to chat with me because there was a problem with the camera. And he said, you know, I bet people don't give you credit for how much acting is involved in being a newscaster. And I really appreciated that because I knew that was true. I knew there was a lot of acting. And one of the big things that I was trying to cover up was that I was terrified of making mistakes. And that's all about being judged, you know. When I now coach people in the fear of public speaking, which is something I love to do, I really focus them on the idea that when they're standing backstage and they're going into that fight or flight system where, you know, their nervous system is freaking out because they're about to be out in front of all those pairs of eyes, they're focusing on performance and how they're going to be perceived by the audience. And if they can flip a switch and focus instead on the contribution that they are there to make, what are they sharing with the audience? You know, what do they have to give? Then all of a sudden, that's a huge relief, and it takes you out of your nervousness. And one day I realized, okay, this concept that I'm sharing with my clients around public speaking is actually true more broadly in life. When we stop worrying about how we are being perceived and how we're performing in the world, we really can relax into ourselves. We can be present in the moment instead of worrying about the future or ruminating about the past. And we can then find joy because, Jim, I believe joy doesn't live anywhere but in the present moment.
And it's an important book. From Showing Off to Showing Up from Nancy Reagan. Thank you so much. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support.